All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. Thanks for attending session 231 titled Latinidad, Afro-Latinidad, and American Activism, Open Borders as a Spiritual Imperative. Same rules apply. Phones off or silent. It's a 60-minute session. If you get rowdy, we're going to have to ask you to go. Members of Hashtag Together Without Borders call out racist and nativist elements in Mormon discourse and seek a voice and representation in Mormon white progressive activist community. All the while remaining active members of the faith, individuals in this organization will share how they perform and frame their activism as people of color with a new kind of liberation theology that racializes and broadens their work within their community and in activist circles outside of it. So I think what we'll do is we'll have each, I'll introduce them, and then we'll have you kind of each give a little spiel, and then maybe we can kind of roll into a Q&A. Does that sound okay?
Yeah,
okay, perfect. Again, we have 60 minutes. Agustin Tino Diaz is the founder and leader of Together Without Borders. He works in education, helping students of color, including undocumented students, finance their education. He also helps bicultural youth strengthen their identities. Laura Lopez is a Mormon and founding member, leader, and organizer with Together Without Borders. A mother, a wife, she is directly affected by current immigration laws. She is a business owner and part of a mixed status family. We're having some technical difficulties, but we're hoped to be joined by Azul Yoribe, who is a Mormon. Mujerista. As part of the Together Without Borders leadership, after being raised stateside and fighting her case in immigration courts for 3 years, she was deported, which caused her great heartache to her family. This has motivated her study of immigration and policy reform in the United States. We also have Tulio Mayorga, who studies computer science here and is working with Together Without Borders. So without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. Welcome our panel, please.
Thank you so much, everybody. We really appreciate you being here and just listening in to what we're going to talk about and discuss when it comes to some of the things that we've been involved with and how we've been involved with them and really what frames those discussions in many ways. My name is Agustin Diaz, but I oftentimes go by Tino. That's just a originally from Brooklyn, New York, and I came out here. I was kidnapped by Utah. I don't know how it happened. It just happened. But I don't even know if I need the microphone. Can everybody hear me just like this? No, it's recording. Oh, okay, my bad. I'm sorry. And then I'm also here with my good friends, Tulio and Laura. And Laura will go ahead and mention many of her own personal experiences involved with Together Without Borders, but also some of the struggles that she's been involved with, and Tulio as well. I'm really more or less here just to provide a background as to how this very local and small movement started and what really, founded it. Like, what were some of the ideological things and conceptualizations that helped create this organization and push us forward in that direction? I don't like to consider this personally as a progressive Mormon front or progressive Mormon struggle. I more or less like to consider this more as an indigenous liberation theology that we've adopted ourselves, that we've created on our own as part of what we want to do. Because this does affect us personally on a very identity kind of level, but also on a very local level as well. And so that's kind of why I like to usually refer to that as in those ways. So to begin with, do you guys want to just say something first, or do you want to let me just go ahead and kick off? Yeah, kick off? Okay. Kicking off. So Together Without Borders started actually as a very digital thing. Various members in the community who did identify as LDS in Utah County, of all places, especially in Utah County. And sometimes I think it's really interesting how places like Utah County aren't considered when it comes to activism or resistance of any kind, but we do exist and we are there, to kind of fight back when we can. And so there were various Latino members in our community who did identify as LDS who wanted to say, you know what, there are things happening within our community, there are things that are going on, and we want to do something. And there were just very few of us, right? There were just me and then, you know, a few others, and we just started this Facebook conversation more or less. And when this, and with this Facebook conversation, it translated into a very strong Facebook message thread that we included various members within the community, but also just outside of the Utah County community as well. And before you know it, we had something being shaped just in that message thread alone. And before you know that, we had a hashtag going on that everybody came to an agreement with, and we decided to push that forward. And then that's what came, that's what happened when it came to the hashtag Together Without Borders, or Juntos Sin Fronteras as well. And that was pushed out. We tried our best to push that out with media, with a selfie and take a picture. I am Mormon, as well as, you know, what the message is as well. Because we wanted to show that even as Mormon identities, regardless of where we were at within our Mormon faith, we resisted a very specific discourse that was very normal in our faith as well as in our communities. And so we wanted to show that. And as we pushed that out and we started thinking more about on-the-ground activism and more grassroots organizing, organic organizing, we began to actually organize in that way by meetings and seeing who was really interested in actually shooting something forward. And there was a transition where many of us were in and out of the organization, where many of us decided, you know, we had to go through a filtering process of who was really interested in the end. And then eventually it came down to, after some work and some time and many, many conversations about how resistant we would be in our activism, whether we would actually cater more towards white conservative Mormons or more white progressive Mormons or more towards our community. And it was a very interesting dialogue that did take place, but it did happen. And as complicated as it was, it eventually worked itself out with, I think, some really strong women to lead it in the end. Azul and Laura, who really pushed forward with these ideas as to what it meant to be undocumented and in the faith as well of Mormonism, but also what resistance looked like in many ways. And so, in many ways, I attribute the leadership and the whole movement of the organization to them, because they've really pushed it in ways that I don't think as men, or even as Latino men, we could have. And so, with that, the three of us more or less sat down and started talking more about how we would do things and what was our philosophies and so forth. We did eventually start supporting some more grounded work here in Utah, as well as in Salt Lake and Utah County. We began to hold actions, especially when it came to the Central American groups that were coming up, the youth that were coming up and passing through Mexican as well as U.S. borders, and then finding themselves here in the United States. Because we realized itself that immigration and the undocumented factor wasn't isolated to just simply a Mexican conversation. It needed to be broadened, especially me coming from more Afro-Latino roots as well, from the Caribbean, from the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. That needs to be talked about as well, because there are many Afro-Latinos who are undocumented, and also who die crossing those ocean borders as well, that we actually don't really talk about at all in many cases, as well as those Central American indigenous groups that oftentimes have to go through two borders, two Western borders as well. And so we wanted to broaden our conversation about, who is being represented and why. And so we engage various topics when it comes to indigenous undocumented populations, as well as Afro-Latino black populations within the Latin America. And more importantly, we wanted to take on a more philosophical understanding of borders, right? A more indigenous understanding of borders, that borders are really just a Western construct that have been placed or forced upon us as people. That borders are really just a social imagination that we are thought, think we have to obey, but we really don't. And so, as indigenous bodies, whether they're Afro-Indigenous or Indigenous American, those are some of the things that we've been taking on and talking about throughout our struggle. And how liberation theology factors into that, well, if you don't know too much about liberation theology, it's very interesting how, you talk about the roots of liberation theology in Latin America with the Catholic priests in the revolution movements that were happening, especially in El Salvador and other places too, where we see religious figures involved in protest and activism within these communities because they understood their spirituality as informing their struggle. And that was perfectly fine with them. And it's a complicated space that I think sometimes is hard to navigate, but it's doable, and it can happen. It can shape our activism. And so as we began to talk more, especially with Azul, about what that would look like, we really found that liberation theology itself oftentimes was looked at in a very European, white concept in many ways. And we wanted to bring that down as to like indigenous brown liberation theology. What does that look like? And how is that framed? And who pushes that forward? Who's represented in many cases? And while those conversations are still happening in many ways, they're still happening. That's the key, right? That they're continuing, and it's a process and that we constantly talk about. But the main point of that being is that our spirituality, wherever it's at, we're not here to dictate what spirituality looks like or what level it should be at when it comes to Mormonism or any other faith-based organization, is that our spirituality was informing our struggle. The teachings of the Savior were basically telling us that borders should not be enforced upon people, that families should not be separated, that there's a specific genderized topic when it comes to women and children crossing borders and what's attacking that. And so as we began to look at more of these things, we also realized that our activism needs to change in many ways. And so it oftentimes would take on the form of sharing stories, looking into our undocumented community and asking many women actually to share those stories. And we have a Facebook page in which a lot of those have actually been pushed out and shared. And so I don't want to drag that conversation out much more than it needs to. But basically, all in all, I like to feel that what we've created is more indigenous, more local, more organic to our community. And on top of that, it's a specific liberation theology that we are still framing, that we are still constructing, but that it is happening. It's in the process of happening. And I think that is probably one of the more powerful things to be creating, is that local people that have included others who haven't been included before are pushing this, you know? And so I'm actually gonna go ahead and stop right there, because I think that really gets at how we started. Which is really interesting, because it was a very digital formation. We started on Facebook, we started on Twitter, on Facebook message fronts, on Instagram, on all those things, and we kind of rolled forward from there into more grounded, on the floor, actions. And so we're still having those conversations. We support really any local actions as well that are happening when it comes to immigration. We don't specifically adhere to anything or anybody when it comes to the immigration activism world. We are here to support local stuff as well as national if we feel like it pertains to us. And so I'm going to say for the second time, I'm going to stop right there actually this time. And I'm going to let my good friend Laura go ahead and talk about a few things that she feels are pertinent to the organization, the movement that we've committed ourselves to, and what the future looks like for us as well. So.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. Can you hear me? Is that working? Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming to our panel. My name is Laura Lopez, and I'm going to be telling you why I'm here, how I got here, how my family are in the United States. Can you hear me there? Sorry. Is that good? Is that good? Okay. Thank you. All right. My father came to the U.S. in 1998. This is about 3 years after Mexico's worst recession, which was caused by the North American Free Trade Agreement. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it really hurt our Latin American economy, Mexico, and everybody else down south, which destabilized financial markets in Mexico and caused a tremendous depreciation of the peso. The deficits that happened during this process left a serious amount of Mexican and South American citizens with no jobs, and this didn't really benefit our people, but brought them great poverty. During this time, my father, who worked for Televisa, which would be the Univision of Mexico here in the U.S., he was laid off, and he had to find a job that paid less to feed our family. It was during this time that big companies, because of NAFTA, had to lay their workers off due to the economic instability that this brought into our country. Mexico's economy did improve a little bit right after the first 3 years that NAFTA was introduced, but my dad wasn't going to sit around for our economy to get better. Bills had to get paid and his family had to be fed. We didn't own any lands, neither the amount of money required to get a visa to come to the United States. So my father, desperate to provide for his family, turned to his brothers in California. and he decided to cross the border. He walked through the desert and made it safely to California. The rough path left him with thorns that are still visible in his hands today. After being 2 years separated from him, he decided that it would be better for us to move here to the U.S. with him. So he sent for us a year later. I crossed the border at age 12 with my 5 and 6-year-old sisters and mother. We walked for about 12 hours. My sisters today remember that as a big hike. They were really young. I remember seeing clothes in the path we followed. I also saw water bottles and shoes. It was then that the journey started to feel very real to me. It was then that I realized that I was living what I saw on TV. Because in Mexico at that time, the news would show you people crossing the border and the risks that involved doing that and everything. And I guess they were trying to discourage citizens from doing so, but it didn't work for our family. It occurred to me that we were crossing the border just like I have seen people doing so on TV, but I didn't let fear take over me. I couldn't completely understand why my parents were doing this and why we had to leave everything behind to come to this place. I do know that my parents wanted the best for us. They wanted to offer a better life for us than the one they had in Mexico, even if it meant risking their lives for it. My mother and father to this day apologize to us for putting us through that experience. And we always tell them that it wasn't their fault and that by crossing the border, actually showing resistance by coming back to the country that contributed to the economic crisis that brought them here in the first place. This is how I ended up in this country and how many other individuals come looking for a place to succeed. They come back to the place that is reaping the benefits of our failing economies in Latin America. Not one immigrant wakes up one day and says, today I'm going to risk my life and take someone's opportunities away. Because their opportunities have been taken away by first world powers. And our governments are being manipulated by these first world powers. I don't remember if I saw in the Panama Papers that. I don't remember if it was the U.S. or European first world power that told American countries, Latin American countries, that they will pull out humanitarian efforts or benefits to them if they wouldn't lower their trade prices. I apologize. These are some of the experiences that have shaped me, not just me, but many immigrants that cross the border every day. Some don't have a good fate when they cross. Many of them die. The fantasy is that they die at the hand of their smugglers, which they do, and at the hands of the narcs, you know, they're smuggling drugs in here, but a lot of them also die at the hands of immigration officials because the immigration centers, they just have a history of not keeping humanitarian conditions for the people that are detained in them. As a convert to the LDS Church, I found a sense of belonging in the Spanish-speaking world. My family felt as if they could belong to a safe space without being criticized or shunned for speaking or looking different. We converted in 2004 and we moved to Utah at the end of 2006. This is when my views of the church started changing and we felt more isolated by the membership. The history and lack of empathy toward our immigrant community was really high and many members were turned away by American members that harassed them to get legal. Utah tried to implement their own Show Me Your Papers law following Arizona HB 1070, which would make anybody that looks foreign basically suspicious of being in the country, undocumented, and therefore qualified to be turned into immigration officials for inspection. This would also affect our family, since my husband is a citizen and I am not. If we were to be riding in the same car and the police happened to stop us, they would search him. And since he's a citizen, they would tell him, okay, you're harboring a criminal according to this law. You're harboring a criminal who is your wife. So you're going to pay a fine and you're going to jail for a small period of time and your wife is going to get turned into immigration and she's going to get sent back. These are the laws that many Republican LDS members in the state voted to get implemented because somehow it threatened the security of their family units. I assure you, I'm not here to destroy your family or your security. I am also boggled by the many people that say our family should have obeyed the laws of the land and that we need to be sent back where we came from. Or when they tell us, you did this to yourself, our country doesn't need any more burdens. What we thought we learned from this gospel was something unconditional love for our neighbor. But when we came to Utah, it was a show me your papers kind of love. I have the knowledge that President Nukdorf met with President Obama to agree on immigration reform to keep families together, to stop separating them as part of the church's message with their proclamation for the family. But unfortunately, written official statements and prayers go so far. I have also been told that the church doesn't make public the fact that they've advocated in silence for compassion toward our undocumented immigrants. But the church has never been very vocal, except for refugees, because they're protecting their religious freedom, and they say that we have to welcome our neighbors. When this statement was given, Azul and I were talking about this, and she, I want to quote her, and she said that wording is very important because as an organization that when a message gets sent out by general authorities, the LDS membership follows it very, you know, to a T. And wording was very important in here because they, as they put it, they were referring to other type of refugees and not the ones that, for example, the undocumented immigrants that have been here for a while. I assure you, they were only talking about one type of refugee, and it wasn't us, the ones that have been here for a while. I by no means demean the struggle of the refugees. It is not an experience to compare to. But when you are told to obey the laws of the land, when the lands themselves are setting up laws to benefit themselves and their own citizens, what do you do? Where do you fit in this lack of separation of church and state? Never mind that we have immigrants dying at the hands of immigration officials in detention centers. You can look up the case of Jose de Jesus and the case of the mother that begged for a dry blanket for her 3-month-old son after crossing through a river who was turning purple at the time of detention and that unfortunately died the day after because they didn't think that this was important enough for an immigrant to get a dry blanket for their baby. Because those officials feel that these lives are meaningless. Never mind that stake presidents and bishops are being deported. Where was the outreach of the progressive Mormons and the church when two white individuals get excommunicated because they're demanding rights from the church? A whole crowd comes to comfort them and to stand up for them. When Latino children are being detained and asked to represent themselves in court, no one asks what they can do. No one advocates for them, and no one will risk getting their image tainted for them because they do not look like them. This is why we need more, I call them Latinx activists within the church. Activists that understand the struggles and can help those being deported. Activists that can raise our voices within our community, the community that excludes us or sometimes doesn't even acknowledge us. We need to hold our own spaces where we can be heard and stop depending on the ones we thought were behind us. If we don't speak for our community, no one else will. Sometimes we're also silenced by other oppressed groups. And sometimes we are forgotten or excluded from issues that we don't seem capable to handle. Our cultures are also appropriated within the circles and outside the circles. And when we try to explain the issue of appropriation to these allies, they shut us down by saying they have been oppressed too, and that we contribute to a type of racism by not allowing them to do what they please with our cultures. But they may take our words and plaster them with pictures non-corresponding to the struggle. Struggles are not borrowed. Just like discrimination and slavery can't be borrowed for your cause. Be respectful of this and be wary of how you use it. To those individuals that might be offended by this, I say your activism or feminism or fight for social justice is nothing if it isn't intersectional. If it doesn't come with a willingness to deconstruct and to listen to the painful parts of what our experiences are as people of color, immigrants and minorities. A good ally makes a space for these struggles. They stand back and listen, and they don't take this as an offense, but rather as a learning opportunity. As a Latina activist mother with an LDS background, I see activism as a critical part of my life. I live with my status from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep, and it isn't something I can easily escape. We can't be silent on these issues because they affect our daily lives. Some people of our own community would say, just get over it. You know, it's going to be fine. You can't. You just can't forget about it. Many families like ours where one partner is undocumented and the other one isn't have this constant stress in the back of their minds about their partner's safety. We have to be extra wary of our cautions because if the authorities feel like targeting you, They will, and you may die at their hands. My husband has been very supportive on, you know, my activism and sharing my story and everything. But at times, he's still wondering, are you going to be targeted because you're sharing your story? You know, you have to think about your kids and things like that. But I tell him that I can't stay quiet. You know, if I stay quiet, we just let other people win over us. And everybody needs to know, as harsh as the reality is, how things are with our immigrant community. I was fortunate enough to qualify for DACA, which is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which President Obama offered to people like that migrated like me that were brought here against their own will when they were young. So somehow with that, I have a sort of protection. But it is also to be known that immigration officials have deported people with these permits, and that they have also deported even veterans that have served for the country for many years, and even citizens, which really doesn't make sense because they don't look American. The fantasy that all immigrants must assimilate or adapt to the ways of the American people when they arrive on this land are also problematic. It is almost expecting an individual to completely erase the essence of their beings to meet the standards what entails to be an American, basically an idea of whiteness. Assimilation has caused horrible events in history that sadly the LDS Church has also followed in this progress. In the past, the Indian Placement Program, the withholding of the priesthood and temple privileges from our African-American members, as well as preventing undocumented members from getting baptized or having the right for temple ordinances because of their status. This is pure colonialism. This is a way to stripe a person from their being. Why can't we welcome people with open arms, since most Mormon pioneers were also immigrants? Why can't we be compassionate and not tolerant, but compassionate? Because tolerance just makes you stand people around you, but it doesn't push you to do anything for that. Compassion pushes you to do things and take action against the things that are not fine with you. With colonialism, my dad has had so many experiences, and I admire his patience because he's always corrected of the way he speaks. And I always tell him that, don't let them tell you that, because, you know, they're not anybody to tell you this. And he just says, it's okay, they don't know anything. They don't know any better. And my sister has also been told to wear less clothes that are not as gangster-like, which I really don't understand, because if you put those clothes on somebody else that's non-white, it just looks the same, but somehow she looks more threatening with her clothes or the way she dresses or she does her makeup. And I want to finish by saying I am coming from a place of semi-exhaustion in a way when I say these things. Because when two political parties toy with your situation and entice a whole crowd to their wishes to gain their vote, you're pinned in the middle. And you don't know what to do. So we either retreat or fight back. And I've chosen to fight back for my family, for myself, for my kids. And I believe in the principles of love and compassion, which are taught in the gospel. You know, this is what churches teach. And I don't believe in the divisions that Christianism imposes on its followers. And the blindfold that everyone carries, saying all lives matter when, you know, a minority is crying for help at the time. Together Without Borders is a movement. It's a movement of resistance and safe space for our displaced indigenous brothers and sisters, as well as people of color. To me, this is true Christianism. In our organization, we're not all LDS, you know, but we believe in these principles of helping other displaced indigenous and people of color. And personally, until the church comes out publicly without being afraid of backlash and starts defending us, then I will probably maybe go back or not. I don't want them to do this for me, but for the many members that they kind of suffer silently. They don't come out and say it because they fear backlash. And I think that's all I have for you. Thank you.
Well, let's go ahead and go to Asul while we have her in case we lose her. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that what I really mean? I feel so I think Laura made some really great points, and I'm always really thankful to hear what she has to say and what Tino and Tulio, they're just such great, wonderful people, and I don't think I need them very much as part of my life, and they've been the pillars that have held up the organization, and I'm so thankful to them. But I think the one thing that has, there have been a lot of things floating around in my mind in regards to this. Obviously, I have a very personal story in regards to Mormonism and immigration, seeing as how I was kicked out of the country and had a 10-year ban put on me, and I'm a Mormon. But I think the one thing that I really would like to focus on today is sort of this missed opportunity in progressive circles in regards to taking this conversation and running with it. Because nobody really is outside of people who are directly affected by this. Christianity in general, but I'm going to say Mormonism specifically because I'm speaking to a predominantly Mormon crowd, I'm assuming, is rife with the exodus of people and the migration of people, starting from Adam and Eve, continuing on to the children of Israel. We have Noah, Christ, Nephi, Jared, Alma. In our modern history of the Restored Church, we have Missouri and finally Utah, and even Mexico with Ciudad Juarez when the polygamy families came over, because polygamy wasn't jiving so well in the States. And I think what this boils down to is I hear a lot of people talking in regards to issues that affect a lot of people, you know, LGBT rights and Black Lives Matters, about, you know, one or two verses in the Bible, or, you know, one or two examples in the scriptures. And we have all of this history with immigration, and we never call on our organization, like, we never call the church out on saying, hey, you know what, scripturally, you have all of this information, and you are doing nothing. Just like LGBT rights and Black Lives Matters, immigration intersects with this, because there are Black undocumented people, there are LGBT undocumented people, there are LGBT Black undocumented folks. And so this obviously connects and affects a lot of people. But I think the one thing that has stayed with me the most is that this is a conversation about control, about where and how a body can exist, and where and how a body can and should be. And if it doesn't affect us at the end of the day, you know, because we feel safe in our body and in the place our body is, we're not going to take it seriously. So I think my invitation to all of you listening to this today is to really sit down and think about not only how you can contribute, but how do you perceive this narrative of bodies existing? Because if yours isn't threatened, you're obviously going to go to bed at night and not really think about it too much. I mean, I know there's a lot of things I don't think about because they don't always affect me, but I'm trying to be more conscious about it. There's obviously a lot on my mind with the election. I live in Mexico, and I get to hear a lot about it from here, and I'm not even involved in anything internet related right now, but it's a scary time for people outside of the U.S. to be seeing you guys go through this, and to be seeing you guys have all these really messy conversations about things that you should be holding your organizations accountable to, because if you can't even hold them accountable to that, in the space where you inhabit, that you have claimed and you have pushed others out of, and where others are dying because their lives are not regarded as equal or as valuable or as necessary, then what does that say about us? who are outside of that sphere. Not too long ago, there was the death of Berta Cáceres, who was an environmental activist in Honduras, and Clinton was heavily involved in that. And so a lot of this election of Trump versus Hillary, I have friends who are environmental activists who have pretty much gone underground because they don't, either way, this election is dangerous for them. And we're not even on U.S. soil. We don't even pay taxes or get any of the brownie points from doing that, which I assume there are brownie points, right? And so I would like to leave you with that invitation or that thought as to how Together Without Borders relates to that and the work that we have done. I think there's definite, as you can see on the table sitting in front of you, there's a mix of experiences. We have everything from Afro-Latinidad to, you know, women, and we try to make a really diverse crowd. Sorry, you guys, I live in the tropics and there's a storm going on. But, and so I think right now, at least the one thing that I feel comes a lot up in conversations is the next step in our conversation, really, in regards to immigration, is not only what does healthy look like for us, but what does broad activism look like? Because from a Mormon standpoint, we've been taught, you know, to look broadly. We're a global church. And we try to be global in our perspective. It's not just the states that's being affected by this. And it's not just the states. The states aren't the only, like, really super crappy immigrant havers. My country has a lot to be ashamed of, and I live right on the border. I live in the Yucatan Peninsula, so I get to see a lot of that. But a lot of how we define or have these conversations really boils down to how much of ourselves we see reflected in other people, and how much we're willing to grant to other people humanity. I know that for a lot of, sorry, again, I know for a lot of the Cuban refugees that reside here, that's been a constant struggle. And I really try to understand that as an immigrant activist, because if they are not included in my circle, then I feel like my fight is meaningless. If everybody who's excluded is not included in my circle, then I'm not doing enough. And I know it's not possible to reach everybody and to really protect everybody. But just like it is impossible to always have my house clean perfectly, the point is that we have to keep trying. It has to be broader, and it has to include more. Because at the end of the day, we're really only as safe and as protected and as human as those who are denied the very, very, very things that we're granted. Thank you.
Before we go on to Tulio, I just want to say, like, I just want us to all remember and hold space for the fact that Azul is not with us. She's joining us via Skype because she was deported and has a ban on her being returning to this country even for a week to attend an academic conference for 10 years. So this is a very serious issue that impacts our friends. It affects our friends and those that we love. And so, again, thank you for that reminder that this should be our issue just as much as the other intersectional issues of oppression and marginalization are. All right, Tulio.
Okay. Hi, can you all hear me back there and everything? Okay, cool. So first of all, I would like to thank, you know, all the people behind this event, you know, everyone who organized it and who coordinated to organize it. I really think events such as this are, like, really important because we have to keep conversations going about topics that are not inside of the mainstream. I think that's a very important and fundamental tool. basically that our society keeps going towards progress, you know, eventually becoming a unified society that's not only tolerant but compassionate about each other, and that we share the same ideals. So I'd really like to thank whoever's behind Sunstone. I think Lindsay, who disappeared out of thin air. Hopefully that's temporary. Okay, so my talk is going to be a little more educational, so to speak. So feel free to take notes. If you have your smartphones, you can sort of Google things or names, events as I speak about them. I'm going to speak a little more about what we try to tackle here at Together Without Borders, which, as the name suggests, is the issue. It's the issue of borders, not really as physical borders, but the kind of societal borders, artificial borders that we set, or that we have set, and still keep obeying. Can you still hear me back there? I think my mic is like dying or something. Oh, sorry. I've been told it a lot. Sorry. On the issue of borders, I'd really like to start by giving an anecdote of a friend of mine, sort of an acquaintance, classmate, not really a friend, who was at school when I, in my first year here, where I was here at the United States. I was a student at LDS Business College, a couple blocks away from here, I believe. This friend, he was very vocal about immigration. He had a very defined, like a hard stance against illegal, quote unquote, immigration, as he expressed about it. One day we were talking, just about trivial, things like how our days were and everything. And along the conversation, he mentioned that he was looking for a full-time job or something. And at that time, I'm under a student visa. And at that time, I still wasn't able to get a job because at the time it was illegal for me to work, even though, I'm under a student visa. And I still had to find a way to pay rent and school, tuition, whatnot. Anyways, he was very surprised by this fact. He actually didn't know that people with visas who come here quote-unquote legally are not allowed to work, or there's a lot of obstacles to keep us from working, from earning money. He was very surprised by this fact. He didn't know this. And his response is still funny to me, even to this day. He just looked at me and he had this face of like, oh, I have a great idea. And he told me, look, have you ever thought about getting an American citizenship? He did say that. I think he even said, have you thought about it? Because that way you're going to be able to work, right? Oh boy, if it was that easy, I don't know. I was baffled. This educated person, college student, did not know that there are such obstacles. He had very strong opinions about immigration. This is a person who used to read, newspapers and politics, watch politics shows and whatnot. He didn't know this very basic thing. He thought that immigration, citizenship, residency, is something that you can, he thought that you can just go to a store and, get an American citizenship with a side of fries or salad, I don't know. Yeah, it was, it was pretty sad. By this point, I've been here for 5 to 6 years or so, and I now know that this is actually a very, very common misconception that a lot of people have. You guys, I know some of you, I know that you, most of you consider yourselves, allies to immigrants, allies to people of color, and that's great. Thank you so much for that. But I am also equally confident that many of you have a very... maybe misguided or kind of muddy, unclear opinion or knowledge about immigration, for good reason. There's virtually zero education, at least in the classrooms, about immigration. And for a country such as the United States that boasts about being what's that really famous phrase, being a melting pot of cultures and nations. This is something that's very, very basic that should be taught in classrooms, but it's not. You know, whether there are reasons that it's not taught, I don't know. I think that's another topic for another kind of conversation. But the fact is that there's not that education in the mainstream, in the mainstream media, or for the average American, something that's really, really important. And, well, as far as the issue of borders and the notion that borders are a societal artificial construction, I just would really like to have you guys think, what are these borders, what these borders are. You know, a lot of people talk about, say, Latin American culture, and they basically compare and contrast it with North American, Canadian American culture. Well, first of all, let me tell you, Latin America, comprises about a little more than half of the American continent. So it's a huge place, right? I mean, it's a pretty big place. I don't think there's really such a thing, such as Latin American culture. You cannot say that all these thousands of millions of people share the same, exactly the same lifestyle, the same traditions. That's just nonsense. So I don't think there's such a thing such as Latin American culture. I think that's a construct. That's a construct that some people still nurture and instill in people's minds to keep us separated, to keep us, to give us another obstacle to overcome, to be united. I think this is very true. Also, about the topic of education, I'd also like to do away with some notions that you might have. You know, the first of all, being the legal immigration versus illegal immigration, quote unquote. Obviously, a lot of people still think and say things such as, "Well, I'm not against immigration. I'm all about immigration. The USA is about immigration. I'm just I just don't agree with illegal immigration." Well, what does that mean? To make a very long and frustrating story short for you guys, I'm just going to go ahead and say that what we know as legal immigration, meaning visas, that's basically reserved for very privileged people, a very small minority of people who can who have the economic means to basically buy a visa, because that's basically what it means. You have to buy a visa. And I'm just going to give you a brief example of what having a student visa means. It means that you have to prove that you have at least around $50,000 that you can spend in a single year, every year. In Mexican pesos, at least, that's that'll be about 940,000 Mexican pesos. That's almost a million Mexican pesos, which is roughly at least 36 times more than the minimum wage in Mexico over a whole year, without taking a single day off during that whole year, including weekends or Christmas or maternal leave. It's still at least 36 times more than the minimum wage. So for most people, at least in Mexico, and it's the numbers are very similar in Central America and some countries of South America, this is just completely out of the question. You cannot you cannot do it. It's impossible, basically. So it's a question of privilege. You have to basically be a famous neurosurgeon, maybe an IT person who works for Google, eBay, Amazon. That's the kind of people who visas are made for. And also, visas are temporary. This is something that not a lot of people know as well. Visas are designed to be temporary. They're not a permanent means of coming to this country. Also, the second misconception, a very common misconception that people have, is they have this notion that a lot of people come here to the United States to do crime. Well, you hear this rhetoric in especially Republican political events, you know, they say, well, we have to secure our borders from criminals. We have to secure our borders because otherwise we're going to be overrun by criminals. You know, that's a very valid fear, but let's just think it through a little bit, you know. So this statement is basically postulating that the criminals are very literally risking their lives crossing the desert to come here to commit crime. They're coming to a country where law enforcement is way more effective than in their home country, but they come here to commit crime? Well, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense, especially... you guys probably know all about Mexican drug cartels and criminal organizations in Mexico, which are thriving. Basically, if you're a criminal, you're better off in one of those countries. Also, law enforcement here automatically targets people of color, so you know that also adds to the nonsensical notion of this statement. This is a very dangerous statement, especially, you know, in this revival of what I call Huntingtonism, referring to Samuel Huntington, who was who was a political advisor to the National Security Council. You guys can Google him. He has a very... I think it's a book that we all should read. It's called Who Are We? It basically talks about the dangers that American identity is facing in regards to immigration. He basically says that American people, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASPs, it's impossible for them to share the same space with Latin American people. Basically, he's pitting us against each other. Needless to say, he is the same person who coined the term clash of civilizations, which was widely used to justify all the wars in the Middle East. He basically said, well, you know, this is what happens when you have Islam and Christianity in the same planet. They're just bound to eventually, kill each other with weapons. I mean, he doesn't go into the specifics, obviously, but he says that's what happens. That's just how it is. People will just kill each other. We shouldn't even do anything about it. So there's that. I really, really want you guys to be inspired by this and try to think about all of these artificial borders. Every time you talk to someone from another country who speaks another language, try to think it through and realize that we are not really that different. I mean... take the Maslow's pyramid, for example. We all want to accomplish that pyramid of needs. We all want the best for our children, for our families. Maybe we have, you know, some very slight variations in how we want to accomplish it, but we still do. I mean, we are way more similar than what the mainstream media wants us to think. Maybe there's a reason for that, maybe not. I don't know. I'm not going to say at this point. But it's definitely something that you all should think about. That's it. Thank you very much.
We have time for a couple of questions. So if you want to get to two questions quickly for our panelists, please come on up to the microphone so we can get you recorded.
Okay. So my question is kind of two parts itself, but I was just wondering what we can do to help your organization and your efforts, and also if there's other efforts and organizations you think we should be also helping if we live here in Utah.
Thank you. That's a really good question. We get that question actually frequently. Right now, there are various immigration groups in the state of Utah that kind of tackle on different things. Like, for example, on August 6th, there's a young girl who's organizing with various other youth and other community partners to do a silent march for a scholarship for undocumented students that's not being offered, right? That we essentially are not like, oh, this is to get without borders. We're just supporting, right? There are various actions that occur within the community from various groups that, you know, support different things, whether it's educational rights for undocumented folks or state rights. It might be a driver's license, you know, something like that. We personally are still working on other things, but I think the best way to get a hold of us and talk more about it and bridge with other intersectional groups is through our Facebook. And we all have access to that. We can also begin that conversation totally. So that'd be great. Thank you.
One more question, anybody? I have a question. So obviously this started out as, well, you guys obviously had lots of conversations prior to deciding what action you wanted to take. But how did you, how do you feel like you've used like social media? Because I think like this is a new, I mean, you, that's what you decided to do was roll out a social media campaign. I took my little picture with your hashtag and I just thought it was brilliant idea. And so what has it been like for you guys to roll out a social media kind of grassroots effort? Because that's newer, right? It's only been the last few years we've been doing that and seeing that done.
So when the I guess it was the first campaign that we ever had, and we had people taking selfies with the hashtags, we didn't know it was going to get that big. And it went all the way to national news in the Spanish news. And what the campaign strategist there said is that if we start using hashtags today in our world full of technology, it's like standing together screaming in the middle of the street, the same thing. So it's been very helpful to, you know, communicate with people like Azul that are in Mexico, you know, as if before we didn't have this, we would have to pick up the phone and do all of that. And that might cost her and us money as well. But it's been a great way to contact, you know, with many, many other people throughout the country, because we also get messages from people that need help and everything. Right now, social media is like an essential part of it. You know, the revolution in Egypt happened because of that, and the government was overthrown. So, you know, it's just a critical part of activism.
So social media doesn't quite have the borders that we have here on the land.
Yes.
Thank you again. Can we give one more hand to our presenters?